With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the Publisher Podcast. It's time for the Publisher Podcast.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going? And welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week. And in this episode, I'm speaking to Reese McLaughlin. Reese is a New Zealand rugby fan, first and foremost. But he is also ITV's director of advanced advertising. I think most people in TV advertising will know Reese as one of the industry's most forthright and candid commentators. He's never afraid to say it like it is when he's on stage. He often articulates it in an extremely funny and entertaining way, probably less entertaining if you're on the receiving end of his sometimes scathing comments. But conference goers will often take away a key catchphrase or analogy or metaphor that he's used, and they'll often remember it a year later, something that I think many industry marketers should probably take note of when they're preparing speakers to go on stage. Looking at the global TV landscape, I think that, you know, whilst Reese has been at ITV, and I think, there's plenty of people at ITV he'd probably want to share the credit with, but ITV has become something of a hotbed of innovation, something I really wouldn't have described the company as, you know, 5-10 years ago. But there's been lots of, relentless experimentation, new announcements, and experimentation with everything from new formats to trading methodologies, data products, all the rest of it. I think Planet V is the most notable initiative, taking a DSP in-house and building technology and data products around it. But there's been quite a bit more going on as we get into in our conversation. In terms of things we've got coming up from Video Week, we're in the build-up to New Video Frontiers, our flagship conference. It'll take place in London from April 15th to 16th. I'm particularly excited about this year's event. Each year when we put these shows on, you're kind of worried about what is going to be fresh the following year. I don't think I've ever seen so much change in one year. It's quite anxiety-inducing for ourselves included. It's not just we often share the the industry burden of feeling nervous about new futures, but it's also a very exciting time. We're seeing lots of new entrants coming through. The dynamics seem to be shifting in pretty much every sector, from clients, agencies, publishers, broadcasters, ad tech. Everybody's facing enormous change, which can be stressful, but times of change also throw up huge opportunity, and we'll be getting into some of those opportunities at the event whilst also addressing the stresses that many of us are going through. Reese will be joining. He'll be on a session that will revisit the TV industry's dilemmas when it comes to whether they should build, buy, or borrow their own ad tech infrastructure. A question that I think before coming into the industry I would have been slightly bemused at me being as excited about that panel as I am, but it's going to be a great session, and that one will be at 2 p.m. on day one, so make sure you catch that one if you're joining us. If you don't have a ticket yet, you can pick one up at newvideofrontiers.com. Okay, so I'll cross over to my conversation with Reese, and I hope you enjoy. So, Reese, welcome to the podcast.
Cheers, Vincent. Good to be here.
So, very chirpy. I've caught you on a good day. So here, Reese, we kick things off, and I think some people might have heard this story before. I know that I have, but it's an interesting story. So let's start there. So what was your beachhead into the industry in the first place?
Less a beachhead, a more a bartender entry into the industry. So when I arrived in London back in January 1995, golly, 31 years ago, I, like most Antipodeans, secured a job as a barman. And I was the barman in the Carpenter's Arms on Whitfield Street in central London, which at the time was the drinking venue of choice for the TV buyers at McCann Erickson. Now, I didn't know there were TV buyers. I just knew that every lunchtime, this bunch of lads would come into the pub, would drink turbo rounds of lager and Guinness, and then head back off to the offices to do whatever they did. And late one afternoon, Tuesday, Wednesday afternoon, 3:30, 4 o'clock, so a long liquid lunch, two of these characters were still at the bar, and they were ordering more pints. And I said to them, at an otherwise deserted bar, I said, I don't know what it is that you guys do for a job, but I'd love to do what you do. And they looked at each other, and they turned to me and said, well, there's a job open, and if you want it, it's yours. So those individuals were Dickie Ball and Phil Tattersall, two legends of the industry. Tatty has recently retired. I had the privilege of attending his retirement function in the summer of last year. I handed my apron over to the bar manager and pretty much walked out on the spot, and I turned up in the reception of McCann Erickson the following Monday saying, I work here now. They're all a bit bemused, but lo and behold, Dickie and Tatty made good on their hazy recollections of offering me the job. And so in May 1995, I started at McCann Erickson as a junior TV buyer on the princely sum of £9,500 a year. Now, you know, things being different back then and inflation and all that sort of stuff, I felt like a very rich man, specifically when I did the calculations of FX, of converting UK pounds to New Zealand dollars. I felt like a very wealthy man. Stayed at McCann Erickson for the best part of just over 8 and a bit years. Moved my way up to be associate director running Sky, Coca-Cola, General Motors, and a couple of other accounts. So pretty big, prestigious accounts. I'd like to say with a great deal of affection and a great deal of pride that I was Dickie Oliver's right-hand man. I was his protege. Learned a huge amount from Dickie, a real legend of the industry and a real stalwart of the IPG business, or the IPG Omnicom business, as it is now. But in December 2003, I was lured by the bright lights and the big things of Mediacom, where I was hired by Dave Jowett to be head of TV implementation or planning. Great job, and just an incredible business to work in at that time. Just as Mediacom really started to skyrocket, and just an exceptionally talented bunch of individuals leading that business, and luminaries, which I think we will all reflect on as being just real market leaders. So Mediacom led by Stephen Allen as the CEO, and Nick Lawson and Ratcliffe as the joint MDs. Karen Blackett, Mark Collins, Dave Jarrett, who I've also already mentioned, Maddie Mees, Steve Gladys, Sean Healy, Steve Bignall joined the crew. Just a remarkable bunch of operators who were the leading lights of media and media buying, media planning, strategy and buying. Just a remarkable education. During my time at Mediacom, Group M in the UK was formed. So I also had the privilege of working with Nick Theakston, who was the CEO there for a while, and another just incredible operator. Over the course of my time at Mediacom, my job parlayed into being head of futures, one of the benefits of which that I had the opportunity, or I made it an absolute essential that I had the opportunity to attend CES in Las Vegas annually, so that I could go and understand what the future would be, and I could come back and talk to our clients about what's going to be coming down the line in terms of the consumer electronics, which would pervade all our daily lives and therefore would have a big impact on how we would best do media planning and media buying. And then more latterly of my time at Mediacom, and as we started to become much more integrated with Group M, I was working on the integrated video strategy as video streaming started to become a thing of note in the UK. And during my last year at Mediacom and working for Group M, we were introduced to a business based in Baltimore that was building a platform for the programmatic activation of streaming video. We just call it video now, don't we? And that business was Videology. And having met Scott Ferber, the founder of Videology, who was previously the founder and successful exiteur of advertising.com, I was absolutely blown away by his passion, his strategy, the clarity of his vision around how this market would unfold. So much so that having established a commercial partnership for Group M with Videology, I was poacher turned gamekeeper. And in early 2011, I joined Videology as head of business development for Europe. I think everybody listening to the podcast, I would imagine, is very familiar with the Videology Icarus-like narrative. So close to a successful exit, but ultimately bankrupt. But what a just a remarkable time, certainly for those of us who had the privilege of building out the proposition in the UK. Just a tremendous, tremendous business that did so much to progress what was capable in the CTV, video streaming, data-powered addressable space. So I say remarkable. I think many of us who were senior within Videology still bear the PTSD scars of what ultimately happened to that business and through the process of bankruptcy. And then through the bankruptcy process, I worked very closely with ITV, who many people may not be aware, made an effort to buy the distressed assets of Videology out of bankruptcy. It was ultimately unsuccessful. Singtel, with their Amobi proposition, were the successful bidder in that process. But during my time working alongside ITV to help them pull together what the proposition was and the framework was for what they hoped to be the successful acquisition of the assets, I became very friendly and professionally acquainted with what ITV wanted to do in the addressable video space. And so, having taken a mini sabbatical, ironically during the COVID months, I was offered an opportunity to join Kelly Williams' team at ITV, where I am today as Director of Advanced Advertising. And that, in the last couple of minutes, is my full and exhaustive employment history. Four jobs in 31 years. 31 years of not being found out, Vincent. 31 years of imposter syndrome, just waiting to land. I'm waiting for it to happen. I'm waiting for somebody to say, just call bullshit on it. And I'll just go, oh, finally. I've been found out.
I don't know. I mean, Videology was one of those businesses that the UK was very much the shining star within that company, I think, wasn't it? It was.
We ran a brilliant business. And while most of your listeners will probably most commonly associate us with the big business partnership that we built out with Group M, and latterly Finecast within Group M, we also had significant, non-trivial business with both Publicis and Omnicom, and a pretty significant footprint across Europe as well. We were a north of $100 million business annually in the European region alone, towards the tail end of the Videology experience, which was in part what made the bankruptcy so traumatizing. We were going just guns blazing over here. We were the default partner. We knew how to get business done. We were the pioneers in the space. We had a great foundation to build out into more markets, into more partners, and into more product propositions. But, you know, hubris, right? And I think, you know, in part, when I reflect back on it, we were maybe a bit high on our own supply. You know, we evidently weren't as good as we thought we were. The financial basis for the business clearly wasn't as solid and as robust as we understood it to be. Bankruptcy is really quite traumatizing, but also it's probably been the most educative and most informative part of my business career. I think I developed more and progressed more through the process of bankruptcy than I did at any other part of my career. And I've had some brilliant leaders and some brilliant mentors, and I've worked alongside some of the best people in the industry. But I would argue that over the kind of 18 to 24 months of the end-to-end of Videology's bankruptcy experience, I grew as a leader, as a professional, and as an operator more during that period than I have at any other point in that 30-year career.
Yeah, I think behind any sort of piece of wisdom where you've fully imbibed, you know, and sort of incorporated into your, you know, mentality or business philosophy or life philosophy, the battle, there's usually battle scars behind it.
Other leaders of the European region, I know, also bear those scars. And now I'm not here advocating for bankruptcy for anybody in the Don't get me wrong, but it genuinely was a period where, you know, on reflection, I learned more about myself, about my colleagues, about trust, about belief, and about my perseverance, I guess. Yeah, not advocating it, but certainly have managed to parlay that traumatic experience into what I hope and I believe in myself, and what I hope other people see is being a better operator in the ecosystem as a consequence.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Yeah. You weren't a bad operator at Videology either. I can remember one of our first events. It was at the Institute of Contemporary Arts, and hearing, you know, I can vividly remember those first events, because I was so nervous about them when we were first doing it, and you're not entirely sure whether you've done it right, and I can remember overhearing somebody saying, "I'm really looking forward to seeing the Videology guy," and I was like, "Oh, great!" I think I'd met you but didn't know you then. I don't think I'd seen you speak, and you smashed it with a really rousing speech that wasn't really about Videology. Here's our tech. Here's what we'll do for you. It was actually fairly close to a lot of the kind of themes that you would speak about now with your ITV hat on. And I can remember being the highest rated slot that day. And we always sort of steer sponsors towards saying, look, the audience will respond a lot better if you just don't overtly sell. And often when you're speaking to a salesperson, they don't always get it. They often do. And there is another way to sell, and it's by, you know, inspiring them, rousing them, it worked. It was very impressive. So
that's very heartening to hear. It would have been nice to have heard that feedback closer to the time. I think that's taken the best part of 12 years to pass that through. One thing that you have touched on there, and it's something that I had to come to terms with, I guess, during my time at Videology, I never saw myself as a salesman. I was never a salesman. Frequently salesmen is you know, caricatured by, you know, like hustlers and grifters and people who want to do deals and stuff like that. So I never thought of myself as that. And what I discovered was actually I was a really good salesman. I am a salesman. I'm a very good salesman. What I discovered during my time at Videology was that if you've got a great product and you are genuinely bringing value to an ecosystem, then sales is more about getting people to believe in what is possible and what the opportunities are and your position or place to best solve for those opportunities and bring value to all parties. So yeah, it's not about selling widgets or platforms or code base or anything like that. The best salespeople are the people who can get other folk to believe that the way that you are proposing to go about doing things is the right way, and a way which will, you know, enrich everybody who participates in the program. But yeah, a cold, hard shock to the system when I realized that, yep, I'm a salesman.
It's I think the best salespeople tend to be, yeah, it's as much about, you know, being able to speak to people and in a convincing way, and not in a, yeah, I was very much the same. It's starting Video Week as a journalist, I was very uncomfortable with the thought of commercial conversations, and I think that's part of the reason anything we do, I kind of feel like I have to be selling something I genuinely believe has value, or else I couldn't possibly do it, you know. Yeah.
What does bother me a little in what you've just shared is that the themes that perhaps I was riffing on back in 2012 or when it was remain the themes that I'm still riffing on today. That's I'm not sure whether that's a damning insight on me as a one-trick pony, or on the failure of the ecosystem to really move forward in a way that is adding value or bringing value to all participants. That's somewhat concerning.
There's problems across the supply chain. It's one thing we go into at our TV Rise event. There's sticking points at nearly every part of the TV supply chain, and nobody has their hands completely clean in terms of contributing towards making it slicker. But getting everyone to align is a very difficult process. I'm, yeah, I mean, want to get into I wasn't really involved in the conversation. I think I was basically jumped in to promote New Video Frontiers that we'd be talking about it. But there was a LinkedIn thread recently. It was partly in response to a post about an article we published on Video Week, a buy-side view article with an agency, AV buyer. I won't name them because I don't think, well, you know, don't necessarily want to talk about that interview necessarily. But the conversation on the thread evolved into a conversation around the value of programmatic. There were also some question marks around, you know, what ITV are doing in terms of innovation. We'll maybe come to the innovation part afterwards, because I think that's interesting, because there has been a huge amount coming out of ITV. Let's go start with the programmatic thing. I mean, I think this is it's a recurring theme for you on stage, off stage, in terms of the value of programmatic to broadcasters, alongside ITV's decision to build Planet V, built on a sort of foundation of the Amobi tech, which sort of came from Videology originally, and. So let's start with programmatic. So firstly,
just for the benefit of your listeners. I'm one of those people who argues with strangers in the LinkedIn comments. I think that's where I find myself after 30 years of continuous of employment and remarkable, right? But also the individual who initially posted, and then him and I had an exchange. We have met in person. It's remarkable. He certainly absolutely entitled to his opinions, and he's absolutely entitled, as everybody is, to express what they consider to be their priorities as a business, because in the very first instance, it's all of us who are employees are responsible for driving value for our businesses, right? And so if in this instance what he was expressing was the view that this was the route that was going to best provide value for his business and the customers of his business, that's his prerogative. I have a different view, and I thought we had a really good and healthy exchange of views in that LinkedIn session, and we both went front foot. And I think that's also really helpful for the ecosystem as well, that when we have these debates, and I do hope that we will have a similar robust and honest debate on stage at New Video Frontiers in just over a month's time, 6 weeks' time, that opinions are important, right? And evidently I have some. I have some very robust opinions, having worked at agencies for a tech provider and now for a broadcaster. And what I struggled to see, and what I was struggling to try and express in that comment section of LinkedIn, is that I've been unable to ascertain that ICV and where we have we work with partners in other markets. We're part of EGTA. We work in a consortium of broadcasters across Europe to ensure that we are driving towards a set of common standards around addressability and CTV and programmatic, et cetera, et cetera. What I've been unable to ascertain to date is there are no platforms that have been able to make the case to ITV where they are bringing accretive and incremental revenue into the CTV ecosystem by providing their platform as a service. Now, what we do with Planet V is evidently we've consolidated the entirety of our digital advertising revenue and the access to our addressable inventory into Planet V, where 100p in the pound goes into working media, et cetera, et cetera. Where other platforms are offering to provide services through access to demand or access to supply, is that the transactions that are facilitated through those platforms are, for all intents and purposes, the best of our understanding, and we do constantly engage in this market, the best of our understanding, it's reworked IO business. We have not been able to make the case for incrementality or accretive revenue entering the CTV ecosystem as a consequence of these businesses providing platform services. And that's it. That's the simple maths. In the instance that any one of these big platforms in our, you know, we meet with them a couple of times a year, all the platforms a couple of times a year, because they've always got new product propositions, new ideas, new ways of tackling, in inverted commas, the ITV problem. And the exam question is always the same. Are you able to provide evidence where you can generate sustainable, incremental, and accretive revenue that would be meaningful for ITV? And here we are entering our sixth year of Planet V being in market. And none of those platforms, none of them, Vincent, have been able to adequately respond to that question.
Is there, and I'm playing devil's advocate here, and this is, you know, and this isn't because I take money from sponsors, and I'm not coming from a shill perspective, but I've heard all the arguments put forward. I think this came up in the conversation was partly, you know, if a buyer wants to get away some budget at the end of the month quickly, that they can just jump on their existing system and shove in an extra 10K to ensure that budget gets away. That'll be
yep.
one.
Do that on Planet V. Yep. You could have a campaign live this evening.
Yeah. And not, yep. no way saying you wouldn't. Then I think some people will say that, you know, when you've got people running campaigns globally, that they're often want a unified system with global access, and that, you know, yep. it's, you know,
the argument to that would be, well, businesses that run globally are most likely already trading with ITV. And will form part of either a client relationship that has commercials associated with it, or an agency relationship that also has commercials related to it. So that wouldn't probably qualify as incremental.
Yep, that's a very solid counter argument. And on the SMEs side of things, then, you know, as we move into smaller advertisers, that, you know, it's always going to be extremely difficult for anyone to go out and aggregate independent agencies, smaller advertisers, and to have them all buying up within their platform, and you're more likely to succeed by being more open to multiple DSPs.
Well, and the counterfactual to that would be, we have evidence that Planet V is attracting new to TV or new to video customers. Since we've launched in excess of 1,500 new advertisers only buying digital addressable inventory through Planet V, have worked with ITV. And we've got such a deep and diverse set of product propositions that we get random briefs in as well. We had a gas fitter in the Sully Hall area, I think it was, that ran a campaign targeting a 90-minute drive time around a selection of postcodes. This is a, you know, small to medium enterprise, a fellow with maybe, you know, half a dozen vans going out and doing boiler maintenance, very specific drive time locations, and weather triggered, so that in the instance that the temperatures drop below, I think it was 8 degrees or something like that, and everybody reaches for the, you know, for the thermostat, that he knew at that point, you know, that his business, the need for boiler servicing would suddenly become a bit more critical. So there's one example of a small to medium enterprise that we have worked with via Planet V. And then there is another. We got one of the best briefs, I think, of all time, which is somebody came into us and asked whether or not in our hyperlocal targeting propositions, we were able to target offshore oil rigs. Now, it was a high-end car dealership is it Aberdeen? I forget where most of the oil workers come ashore. But there was a high-end car dealership that wanted to promote Porsche or Ferrari or Lamborghini or whatever, but wanted to target viewers who'd be watching ITVX on the oil rigs. We were able to partly address that because the oil rigs don't have, you know, postcode or the IP addresses are unstable on all the device IDs at an oil rig level aren't necessarily the fidelity that you'd hope for. But these are the sort of customers now that come into us as we've normalized Planet V in the market. These are the sort of briefs we get asked to respond to. And I find that really heartening. We've got 5,500 users on the platform across all the big agencies, the big indies, the boutiques, the regionals, and the day traders that might only buy one or two campaigns a year or for a week or whatever it might be. So we've normalized it. And I think the market understands how to best navigate it as well, to the extent where we get briefs like that in. And there's a bunch of bakeries and mar and par shops and the et cetera, that run on the platform. We bring repeat business. So we're obviously also working with Sky and Channel 4, brilliant piece of collaboration, to find a path to market to make Universal Ads work in partnership with FreeWheel. Really excited about that because, and this is very important, Vincent, we believe that UA will bring incremental and accretive revenue into our balance sheets. And it's a collaborative platform, Channel 4 Sky, ITV, powered by Freewheel. And we're really excited about that launching later this year because incremental and accretive. And you might hear quite a lot of that on stage on the 15th of April.
Well, we'll open it up to
one drum, and boy, will I fucking bang it.
Yeah, it's I can't think of it of being shown a case study where, yeah, definitely demonstrated. Maybe I have been.
I get a part for buyers having private marketplaces with a bunch of your premium video supply and a series of private marketplaces or curated marketplaces in a DSP is of value when you look at through the lens of efficiency. One platform where you can manage multiple suppliers. I get that. That's an efficiency play. But you're paying between 25 and 36%, sometimes more, for the privilege of that efficiency play. And that's a lot of money being extracted from the ecosystem. That's a shit ton of value that's not going on working media. And I think, many of our listeners will have been bored of hearing me say this, but when you're, an ad-funded business like ITV, where the revenue that you generate from advertising directly flows through to what you can produce, what you can commission, what you can acquire, how we can ensure that, really important sporting events remain free to air. An upstream take rate, between 25, 36, 40% is not a sustainable business model for us. So unless those platforms are generating incrementality of above that 25 to 36%, it's extractive. That is revenue leaving our ecosystem, and that is revenue that we are less able to deploy on entertaining the nation, reflecting and shaping the culture of the nation, and the essential public service broadcast responsibilities that we have. So there's quite a big delta in the market that needs to be solved for before we as ITV would genuinely feel that there is a case for relaxing our guard around Planet V and working with any one of the big platforms, because that's quite the delta.
Is there a number on take rate where you think that would be a sustainable one? And I've spoken on the podcast, Andrew Casale, for example. I think he got in trouble with his marketing team for saying as much, but Andrew views the long term future of his business being, look, we might at some point be a slightly boring, low margin pipe that feeds supply, and that's where we're trying to get to in terms of bringing down costs and everything like that. But is there a number where you think that, percentage where you think that might make sense? Or if we crunch the numbers on what we spend on our own sales and marketing?
Really, the maths is quite easy. If you're charging, 25% platform fee for the bells and whistles of your DSP, are you bringing 26% incrementality into my business, right? Is it sustainable as well? And, there's always ways you can game the system and show that you're in short-term, generating incrementality. We need sustainable, scaled revenue. And right now, that doesn't appear to be on the table. There's also a bunch of other issues, which are, I guess, softer and more cultural in their aspect. And what inventory would we be adjacent to in these platforms? What else is deemed fit for purpose? What else has been run as premium supply in these curated marketplaces that might give us pause for thought around congruency or adjacency to that inventory, which is not to say that we're gatekeepers or we police what quality is or anything like that. But we do, you've got to remember, and it's really important your listeners understand that we have quite a rigorous public service obligation at ITV. And it means that we can't always participate even if we wanted to, because we are scrutinized in a way that almost no other media business in the UK is scrutinized. We are held to account in a way that no other media business is held to account. And in the instance that we were to fuck up something, the regulatory framework for penalizing us for fucking up is quite robust. So it would preclude us in many instances from feeling confident that we can enter you know, an open programmatic marketplace, for example, because it, frankly, it's a fucking bin fire out there, isn't it? It's a hot mess of fraud and bots, or, you know, the sanitized term, invalid traffic, and partners who are knowingly turning a blind eye to supply that is sourced or originates from bad parts of the web. You know, there's a couple of instances just in the last 6 months where ads were running on sexual exploitation of children sites, and most of the large technical players were running tags on those sites, and it was considered appropriate supply. Now, if we work with a technology partner that was found to be serving or legitimizing those environments as fit for purpose for ads, then my board would be most likely pulled in front of the culture secretary, and the beatings would be very quickly cascading down to my desk. So there's a lot that's happening in the open programmatic ecosystem that would need to be really tidied up and be brought into order for us to even entertain. And then right now, it doesn't seem like anybody's motivated to do that. I don't think anybody is incentivized to do that. I can relate to what Andrew Cassell is trying to do over at Index Exchange, for example. But there's also, you know, my favorite phrase, there's also a bunch of bad actors out there that are in no way, shape or form incentivized to try and tidy any of this up because they capitalize in the chaos.
But to what extent do you think that capitalizing on chaos is willful? Is it this happens on our platform and, you know, in some cases, billions show up in our bank account every month?
Yeah. I think it's just a normalized and accepted part of the calculus. And it does, as I reach the latter part of my career, it bothers me, and it bothers me more so than it used to. And I think, you know, this is where you'll find me arguing with strangers in the comment section of LinkedIn. We should care. We absolutely should care. The revelation, you know, that Meta were knowingly running something like, I don't know, $14 billion worth of scam ads a year is just quite extraordinary. That's just, you know, soz lads. It is what it is sort of approach to it. It enriches their bank balance. It enriches their bank balance at a seven times multiple of what ITV generates in ads in a year, right? I just think that's fucking nuts that as an ecosystem, we all think this is okay. And so I think there is an unwillingness to really address the problem. I think that there is complicity in that. I think as long as everybody gets paid, everybody's prepared to be lackadaisical about addressing the core root of it. But simultaneously, like, it's nuts, right? The Meta also rewarded IAB's gold standard right at the end of last year, right? While simultaneously, you know, revealing that they were running 14 billion, or it may have been less. It may have been a bit less, I believe the spokesperson said on stage last, a bit less than 14 billion, but it still runs into the double digit billions of dollars annually in scam ads. And then you've got invalid traffic, right? And the expose late last year that there were four platforms responsible for something like $6 billion, you know, dollars in attributable ad revenue that was being allocated or being consumed by bots and other fraudulent means. Which brings me on to another issue, which I really grapple with as an angry old man shouting at the clouds, which is the extent to we as an industry, because we are all complicit in it, that we accept the sanitized language that deflects, diminishes, and trivializes things which are actually quite profound. So we have unsanctioned uploads of content onto YouTube. We have invalid traffic. We have these terms that very much deflect from what the reality of what is going on. And in any other market, these things would be known as fraud or theft or IP infringement. And what we tend to do as an industry is try and wash it away by creating these sanitized terms that diminishes the crime that is taking place. I don't think that would be acceptable in a financial institution. I don't think that we were actually, I might retract that statement.
We need to learn from the bankers.
probably not the best reference point to make. But I think, you know, from a business ethics and business morality perspective, we really need to get a grip on what's going on if we want to leave or pass on a thriving, healthy ecosystem that works for everybody. And I genuinely mean everybody. Advertisers, agencies, publishers like ourselves, technology platforms that add value, and critically, people, real people, and the inshitification of the internet and the AI slopification that is coming down our pipes at the moment really gives me cause for concern regarding where we are at. And unless we undertake meaningful action to address it, what comes next? Old man shouting at clouds.
No, I really agree with you with the, you know, like what you're saying about the terminology we use and the euphemisms we use for something where, you know, fraud is very explicitly obvious when it's the, you know, guy calling from abroad who's trying to con your mother out of her savings by trying to get her bank information. And
we have a fundamental problem that a talent contracted to ITV, Martin Lewis, the UK's leading and most trusted money saving expert, just plays a game of whack-a-mole trying to take down ads that have his likeness in them, offering deals and benefits or whatever to customers on Instagram or on Facebook or on Twitter. It's a constant carousel of whack-a-mole trying to address that. So it affects everybody. And the complicity is that in the main, people kind of shrug it off as, you know, the cost of doing business in these platforms or the cost of consuming content in these platforms or the trade-off that we take as consumers and what we see. But it befuddles me how lackadaisical we are as an industry, how lackadaisical clients are, actually, the advertisers themselves around these platforms facilitating, enabling these things, and them also running ads there. You know, it's the kind of general shrug nature of it all. Oh, well, you know, it happens.
It does. Yeah, and I agree with you. It just doesn't seem... I think it's often... you know, they feel that there's a commercial imperative and a business imperative, and if they're not there, their competitors will be.
Yeah. I saw Scott Galloway posted something last night, and I think Scott's generally a pretty good dude in this space. And he leant into the contradiction in him actively looking to disentangle his business interests and what he does from the metaverse. All things Meta, and somebody had rightly said, well, it looks like you're doing a lot of promotion on Instagram at the moment. And he said, oh, I'm not doing promotion. There's no paid promotion. But yeah, Instagram is a platform where my viewers, my listeners are. And so I do share content to Instagram and, you know, through gritted teeth, because that's where I'm able to best broadcast my message. Do I like it? Fuck no. Right? Am I complicit in it? I guess so. Am I conflicted by it? You fucking damn right I am. And it was really interesting. Like these things are an essential and well-distributed part of our lives now. I just wish we could do better. I think this current incarnation of late-stage capitalism concerns me.
I do feel it needs to be, you know, I think regulators and governments are afraid to tackle it, partly because of politics and trade and the fear of repercussions, particularly with the Trump White House.
With the White House and their efforts through lobbying, evidently, to ensure that all the US big tech businesses are excluded from any application of regulation in the European region. I think it's... Yeah. What do you do?
There was a piece in the FT lately about, you know, how, you know, all this talk of, you know, oh, the under 16s aren't able for it. Well, you know, the parents aren't even paying attention to their children half the time whilst scrolling through these apps. And I've found myself doing that myself in the past. And I do feel like maybe the adults need to form a consensus that we're going to take a lead in taking the step first and coming off those platforms or replacing them with more ethical versions of them. And, you know, provide a kind of consumer-led incentive. I think that we've sort of bought into this idea that you can't possibly come off that anymore or whatever. But, you know, people come off Facebook and still have perfectly functional relationships with their friends on other apps.
Yeah, there are alternatives. And I'm not suggesting that they are only bad. They do serve an essential, you know, social purpose in many instances. And I am on all these platforms. And you know, quite evidently, I'm across LinkedIn arguing with strangers and other strangers' comments. You know, these are our business tools. These are our advertising tools. These are our social platforms. It's just, it's a belief, and it's a belief that I've been working on for some time professionally, and one that I'm, you know, that codifies a lot of the work me and my team do in Ad Labs, for example, and on Planet V, which is a belief that things can be better, that the things that we have to hand now are good but can be better. And if we can ally and align ourselves around making things better, I'd depart the industry when I'm eventually found out and my imposter syndrome is made real. I'd part the industry feeling like we were moving in a direction that was going to improve everybody's lives, professionally and personally. Better. If we can just be better. Yeah. Otherwise, good business for lawyers. And I think that the whole effort to regulate and inhibit, you know, monopolistic behaviors from platforms that are already well and truly beyond regulation is just good business for lawyers. And in the main, you know, it always amuses me when the European Union are going to threaten to fine Alphabet $14 billion or whatever. They're like, oh, that's a day's profit. Never mind. You know, it's rounding error stuff for most of these businesses. Meanwhile, lawyers continue to engorge themselves on the fees. So, yeah, I think I wish I'd actually worked at a pub adjacent to, you know, Temple or legal community rather than advertising.
Yeah, I think the legal community might also come in next week and we'll make you a lawyer. But also, I can feel for graduates who are out there and trying to get into industry at the moment and kind of, you know, you don't want to share that story with the book. This is how we did it in my day. You just ask the blokes in the pub. And
you raise a really good point. I've got a son he'll be graduating university next year and he'll be entering the workforce. And we've recently hired a junior position in my team. So working in advance ads at ITV, working on the Ad Labs business unit. So really working at, you know, the pioneering part of ITV commercial where we build these new ad formats and prototype and trial new ways of building out better propositions for our customers. And so great job, I think a brilliant starting point in the industry, not just because it's in my team, but because what we're doing is so progressive and we've got such a big platform to work on. And there were over 180 applicants for the role. And I sat with my team and said, we're going to go through every 180 applicants. I think it's our responsibility to ensure that we are properly assessing and evaluating and shortlisting from full 180. So there's four of us went through. I reviewed 45 CVs in the process. And what struck me, Vincent, was of the 45 that I covered, 43 of the covering letters were written by ChatGPT. 43 out of 45, and it was all ChatGPT. All the letters started exactly the same, and the two that wrote as individuals were shortlist. Were two of the shortlists. We went from 180 down to 15, I think it was, and then six interviews. But the two that were able to express their humanity through originated, you know, self-originated covering letters really cut through really quickly. And it's not that the other candidates that I reviewed, it's not that their covering letters were any way, shape or form wrong. It was that I believe that those candidates felt that in a world of AI, where in many instances, AI is the first two filters, I believe, at most companies for evaluating candidates to be shortlisted. We didn't, we went straight to human. But I'm assuming that these candidates go, right, if an AI is going to look at my resume and my covering letter, I'm going to have to use an AI so that it can be recognized. You've got this kind of symbiotic understanding between an AI generated piece of content and an AI assessed piece or evaluated piece of content. So it's not that these candidates were doing the wrong thing. It felt to me like they felt they needed to do this just to get through to the human stage. And that was like, is this what we want? Because the human element of our business is so critically important. And over the course of the last couple of years, I feel that as an industry, we've placed greater value on IQ and at the expense of EQ. And I had the good fortune of working with just remarkable people over the years who would just win in every aspect of their professional lives by just having incredible EQ. Reading rooms, understanding individuals, understanding how to change their tone of voice, their angle of conversation, on the basis that it was people. We are in a people to people business, and it just struck me in this graduate recruitment process that there were machines writing for machines. And I've talked to my son about this, which is how are you thinking about how you will best express your personality, your humanity, in the process that you're applying for jobs? This is not talking down on AI or the benefits that AI will bring to us at all, but it just really struck me that it was the default out of the gate position that a ChatGPT would write for what they assumed was an AI filter in the process.
I had an AI generated CV come through, and coincidentally, they'd worked at a publication dedicated to covering video and CTV advertising in the UK, alongside an AI a publication dedicated to AI media marketing. We're the only publication in both of those markets. We have lots of there's a wide field. We're the only competitors who just do those things, and. He'd obviously was thinking this is the perfect CV, and I kind of worries me a little bit that people don't have enough guidance. I mean, to be honest, I'm impressed that enough of them bother to write a covering letter, because so often I don't get one, and if I do get one, I can tell that they've looked into the company a bit, they've thought about why they would like to work in it, they think it looks quite interesting, even if there's some slightly naive things. I really like when people are honest in an interview and say, it's just a sexy industry, isn't it? And I like that. You're excited by the prospect of working here. I had the same feeling when I came into it. I was like, wow, this is amazing.
Because it connects, doesn't it? It connects. It's like, this is a human. I can, when you've got you've got 43 covering letters that all start with, I am very excited too, and then just play the brief back to you.
Yeah.
Like if you were excited about this opportunity, I'd expect you to put pen to paper, metaphorically speaking.
Yeah.
And express your personality in that process, which is, look, and I'm really not talking down on AI as well. I think we are. I think it's going to have a profound impact. Everybody knows this. It's going to be fucking massive, right? And it's going to be all pervasive, all penetrative, just penetrates every part of our, will penetrate every part of our life. But I like to think that I would argue that these next 4 to 5 years will be at the, it'll be the Napster version of AI, not Spotify or the Apple Music version. And I think we're going to work through some of those teething problems. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see where and how that evolves. But,
What you were saying earlier about the, being adjacent, within a programmatic platform and being adjacent to maybe some lower quality stuff that might be presented as a comparable alternative to ITV, for example. It made me think partly about what I've heard about, some of the broadcaster concerns around Project Origin, or Origin as it's more known, which is that something you can speak to? It's not something that we've...
It's not best covered here. What I would say on it is, not all things are created equal. And if you are going to apply a baseline measurement attribute to a 6-second skippable adjacent to dog videos, as you are to a 30-second sound on centre break of the rugby this weekend, then you are dragging the floor down. You're not raising the ceiling. You're not measuring better. What you're doing is you are making apples equals oranges, or in my metaphor, famously, you are making tomatoes in the fruit salad acceptable.
It's yes, that was that's become.
I've bad acted so far, and I've got to put some apples. I've got to put some tomatoes in the fruit salad. it's the measurement of everything and the value of nothing, right? And it's reducing everything to a baseline metric, which doesn't reflect the nuance, the complexity of how people consume media across devices and platforms. And the complexity and nuance and diversification of what that media is. Reducing everything back to a set of ones and zeros, I think, does nobody any favours.
And then while we're on the theme of things you probably can't speak that much about, the Sky acquisition, how are those negotiations going?
you tell me, Vincent. You're a man with the ear to the ground. You've got your channels working. Not my pay grade, my friend, but I will say from a personal perspective, I really hope it goes through. I really hope it's approved. I think Comcast run a brilliant business with Sky. I think the opportunity for us to collaborate as an entity will be really significant for the industry. I think together we will be better. And I think together that we will be able to build better things that reflect the culture and shape the culture of the nation, and give television some heft to compete more evenly with the big technology platforms that are otherwise dominating the landscape. But that's from a personal perspective. It's not my work stream, because quite evidently it's not Reese's pay grade at ITV.
I knew it asking the question, but I'm more doing it to cover my own back. I don't look ridiculous for not asking. But when it comes to... do you think consolidation is a better alternative to collaboration? I mean, you've obviously got collaboration going on with Universal Ads, but yeah. We've seen, and I say this,
so we talked about Origin, and we should also touch on Lantern,
which
to build out a codified approach to outcomes that properly attributes outcomes to television in a way that is holistic across the broadcasters. So a really important proposition, a really important piece of work that's been undertaken by my colleagues at ITV and counterparts at Channel 4 and Sky. And we're really confident will enable us to finally bring a gun to a gunfight on outcomes. Whereas previously, obviously, we were noodling around in the edges, trying to ascertain the best way of proving this stuff out, while the platforms really dominated, because they've got, end-to-end signals that enable them to very quickly draw lines between exposure and attribution. We're getting there. Well, I think it's a really, really important piece of work, and it's really been heartening to see the way that all the broadcasters have aligned and are collaborating in a really, truly collegiate way to get that done.
And so, it is,
not only my colleagues at ITV, and really testament to the willingness for folk at Channel 4 and Sky to solve for this as well.
I think globally, the UK TV industry has probably been best in class on many different projects when it comes to collaboration on different things. And that's often, there will often be people within all of those organizations who still, carry the competitive baggage that, they've had beaten into them probably in the 90s and 2000s. As a result of being competitors. But I think for the most part, we've seen very successful initiatives. But like, I'm curious about when these things don't work out, and there isn't, we've seen various collaborations where, the wheels have come off, or maybe people have lost interest for various reasons. I'm curious about to what extent can people anticipate if a collaborative project is not going to work out, and how do they avoid that, and what needs to be done to make these things work, in your opinion?
Trying to think of what examples you may be thinking of. I've only been at ITV for 6 years. So I'll tell you what is difficult is collaborating across borders. I think that's challenging. We're a global television industry that speaks a multitude of languages, both literally and metaphorically. We have different currencies. We have different buying platforms. We have different agendas, different partnerships. And so finding we have a common set of opportunities and problems to solve for in the main, but it's when you're quite literally dealing with businesses that operate in a fundamentally different way because they were German by origin or Portuguese or whatever it might be. That's way more challenging. That's really difficult. It's in the UK, I think, you know, over the course of the last few years, there's been a real shift in tone, in receptivity, and in a willingness to collectively solve for the big things that we need to solve for: platform standardization, measurement, outcomes, currency, etc., while contending on ad revenue and contending on audiences and contending on programming acquisitions. I think we are still fiercely competitive with Sky and Channel 4 in and around those things, while, you know, being very collegiate and very bipartisan on solving for the higher order problems that, when we solve for them, should bring incrementality and accretive revenue into our ecosystem. I think, you know, RAC at Channel 4 has been really instrumental in bringing a new Channel 4 narrative to the table. While Priya was at Sky, I was really impressed with Priya at Sky. I think she was a remarkable operator. And I think Channel 4 are going to really make some really significant steps forward under her leadership. I'm really excited for Karen, having joined Sky in the managing director role, and I'm confident that she's able to execute brilliantly in that space. So what we have in the main is a new set of leaders who are unencumbered by the baggage of history in the television industry. And they are coming to the conversation with a really progressive agenda and a progressive mindset and a willingness to lean into solving the problems which otherwise divided us. It's a great time and a privilege to be in television, I've got to say.
Interesting. Yeah, it's interesting, actually, I've individually enjoyed seeing all of those people end up in the positions that they've ended up in, but I hadn't really joined the dots on how what they bring to the table in terms of their personalities. In Karen Eccles's case, you know, she's a lot of experience of collaborating with other publishers in the publishing world, I can just really see what you're saying there in terms of them all being able to come together in a sort of collaborative way. That's very interesting thought. I'm curious about, you know, in terms of your own innovations, I think TV still gets hit, and I think it's kind of like an outdated view of the TV industry that it doesn't innovate, that it's not willing to change, and they sort of imagine these sort of musty old men who are wedded to, you know, TV.
How absolutely dare you?
Yeah. And in fairness, there might have been a time where I'd be like, oh, come on, like, really get your act together. We need to see, you know.
Do you know what, you know, Vincent, I'll cut across you there. What as an industry we didn't do very well was market our innovative programs as well as we ought to have. Mm. As an industry.
Yeah.
Because what we just discussed, from a legacy perspective, innovation was a point of competitive advantage. So why would you go public on all these big innovative things you're doing in the instance that it was enabling you to take, you know, an advantageous market share versus Sky or Channel 4? So we tended to be quite discreet about the innovation we were doing, or the propositions, the ad products that had been built that we were, you know, promoting and commercializing with our advertising partners. So, you know, for example, when I joined ITV, we already had weather targeting as an option for our customers, and we just hadn't properly marketed or promoted it. We had runtime ad replacement. We've been working with Yo Space for a really long period of time in being able to do ad replacement in runtime and in streaming and linear viewed over IP. There's a whole bunch of innovations that were already existing, pre-existing in ITV's business, and not dissimilar at Channel 4 or Sky, that we'd not really none of us had bothered, you know, for the reasons I just described, to properly market and publicize as areas of innovation. What we did is we codified it as ITV Ad Labs. Here is a place where we do innovation. Here's all these programs of work, these prototypes, these beta versions, these pilots that we're spinning up. Come and play around with us. Come and be test pilots on some of these propositions. And it's a joy to work on. And I've had a brilliant team. I've had the privilege to work with some real market experts in the development of some of those propositions. We've mostly had hits. We have also had some misses, the things that have gone awry or things that haven't worked in the way we expected them to work. But the beauty of codifying as an ad labs is you own publicly those mistakes or publicly those fuck-ups or publicly those failures to launch. And you learn how to iterate, improve, and you work with your customers on that. Everything that we do in ad labs has an advertiser partner or set of partners associated with it. So that we're not just building things in the lab going, you know, what if we glue this thing to that thing and see what happens? Like, well, we've got this idea that if we are able to hack this thing into this place and layer it with this data point, is this a thing that solves for a customer need? So a classic example of that would be our lead gen format, which has been in the market for the last couple of months, whereby in the instance that you're watching ITVX in a Samsung household on a Samsung smart TV, an ad might appear that will enable you on the remote control, two presses of the button on the remote control, generate a lead for that advertiser. So it was a series of hacks that we did to get this prototype into market. And it's just done so well. It's been probably the best ad format that we've launched in the last few years. It's so good that we're going to take it out of market at the end of March. Do a rundown on everything that we've learned in the process, and we're going to bring it back into market in quarter three, activated across the entirety of the CTV ecosystem. So whereas the pilot was just on Samsung devices, we have roadmap development to take it out to the entirety of the CTV ecosystem. It's been a brilliant format, Vincent. It's done so well. For one of the car brands that were trialing it, first test campaign we ran, in the first week, it generated so many leads that the car brand's lead fulfillment specialist elected to not process the leads because they thought there was an error in the process and needed to QA it. How about that?
Oh, God.
Now, that's an award-winning paper, right? This thing was so good. This thing performed so well that the specialist in lead fulfillment flagged it as an error. But that's the extent. And it's worked brilliantly from car brands, Yankee Candle, a brilliant campaign for Yankee Candle, Government for Recruitment, British Heart Foundation, a bunch of brands that are using it for a wide variety of purposes. So we're really excited to be genuinely pulling that out of market to build it back bigger, better, faster, and more impactful for a wider bunch of advertisers. But that's a case of innovation that we've codified in ad labs and that we very publicly present to the market. Now, and quite often the process is we will present the prototypes publicly. So we set ourselves out for public scrutiny. We own these things publicly. I think that's really important because it helps us reassert ITV and television in the broader narrative around digital innovation and what's possible.
So just explain that for me. So they double click.
So if you're watching ITV streaming, this could be on demand or live in your ITVX app on a CTV, Samsung CTV. Yeah?
Yeah.
You with me so far?
100%. What does CTV stand for?
You're on the ITVX app on Samsung.
Yeah.
You're watching a piece of content. An ad break comes up. It might be a pre-roll. It might be a mid-roll. It might be a linear ad that you're watching because you're watching the rugby this weekend, right? There will be a call to action that is surfaced and trafficked with that ad. And that call to action would be if you want to book a test drive with this car brand, or you want to book a brochure, or you want to book a callback or an email from this brand, two clicks to the remote control. The first click is two fields that are pre-populated by items associated with your ITVX registration. So when you're registered to watch ITVX, we collect 6 fields from you, you know, name, email address, postcode, gender, street address, date of birth, right? So we have those to hand. So that device is associated with a registered viewer. So one click of the button is vincentflood@gmail.com, this postcode, yeah? Second click is confirm. So not asking people to do second screen, not asking people to pick up their phone or scan a QR code. We're keeping you in the ecosystem. We're keeping your hand on the remote control. And within 3 or 4 seconds, you've processed that opportunity. That's it.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I had zero awareness of that. And
you have a publication a week, and that is probably the most progressive ad format that we've developed and launched as a prototype in the last 6 months, and you have zero awareness of it. And there's me just talking about how important it was to own these things publicly, and one of the industry's most primary publications has failed to acknowledge
maybe,
it.
Maybe we have covered it, and
we've corrected that now. We're working with Captify on automated contextual targeting, another brilliant product, I think, where we're using their machine learning proposition, Captify's machine learning proposition, to scan and to categorize and catalog moods, moments, and objects in our shows, so as that our advertisers can target breaks adjacent to those mood, moments, objects. So when there are meal times happening in our shows, or whether a car or a mobile phone is present, or when there are moments of elation or sadness in shows, these are now contextual targeting components that are available to buy in Planet V for our customers, all powered by Captify's AI. It's a really, really smart product and is enabling us to tap contextual 2.0 budgets, which is a bit of a thing in the industry at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. It sounds like you need to start sponsoring events to talk about all this stuff. Just dropping that in. Final question. If I gave you $10 million to invest, where would you invest it and why?
If I was after pretty safe, secure growth from that, a good return on that, I think Amazon is undervalued at the moment. You probably weren't expecting me to say that. Look, I think Amazon wins everything eventually. And then that's not being down on my business, or generally down on the Amazonification of our lives. I think that they're just such a good business. It's been so well built. And is so adept at entering new categories and solving for real, genuine problems, both in media and marketing, and for consumers as well. I think Amazon is going to be awesome moving forward. And then let's say I put $5 million there. The other $5 million I'd probably put into Apple. I've been really interested in Apple recently. They've basically not put any capital into developing AI. And which is quite extraordinary, right? You think all their competitors that are out there spending tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars in the development of AI propositions. And somebody did a piece on this recently, and I was like, oh yeah, fuck, of course. They're just waiting for a winner.
Yeah.
And then that winner needs a device and a platform to get into the hands of consumers, don't they? All right.
I think you probably saw the same chart I did where, it just had a massive hockey stick graph for Meta, Google, Amazon, and they were just sort of flat on CapEx.
It was CapEx, wasn't it? And all those businesses massively exposed on those CapEx investments, and not all those businesses will win. You can't, and Apple just quietly going, we'll stay out of this one, lads. Let us know when you're ready, because what we do have is the biggest global network of devices, and you're going to need to get those, that you're going to have to get your thing into the hands and into the desks and the devices of the individuals. And like two unlikely ones. There's a couple of other businesses that I've seen and that I'm party to that are very early stage that I can't speak to now. I think there's really good things happening over. Robert Webster's business Tower seems to be doing really interesting stuff in the AI space. I saw old colleague John Block talking about what he's also doing in the AI space and the consultancy and that I suppose that stuff looks really interesting. And I think we're going to see a new wave of AI-enabled, AI-empowered entrepreneurs being spun out of our old networks, I think. And I really wish, you know, the people who have the fortitude, the bravery, and the belief to build out propositions for us, I really wish them the very best. They are good people looking to do good things.
They are, yeah. Is it Solipsis or Solipsis, John Buck's business? We've got John speaking at...
New Video Frontiers.
No, Future Week Forum, which will be on around the same time, mid-April. And we'll have Tao involved as well at some point. We're very close with Tao. And in the UK, and probably, you know, globally, they're one of the most sort of trusted groups of people I go to about what's actually happening with AI. So
there you go, we're aligned on that,
and good people, like you say. I think that's a really important thing. Yeah. It's that there's good human beings who, you know, want the best for their clients and best for people, and people I would trust and have an ethical backbone.
We've come full circle in that respect, definitely. Yeah. I believe that those individuals, for example, are looking to add value to our ecosystem? Categorically, I think, you know, ethically, morally, really sensibly grounded, and certainly in both instances, I know both individuals, they also believe in better. They believe in making things better. They believe in contributing to making things better. And as we discussed earlier, I'm here for those sorts of people and those sorts of businesses. And, you know, how I can help amplify other businesses that are doing the same. Yeah, good stuff. Vincent, it's been brilliant to chat. I think your listeners may be disappointed about the lack of swearing.
You got a few in there. You got a few.
I was largely restrained. I'm holding all that all back. 15th of April, New Video Frontiers, where I will be unchaperoned, unbriefed, and unfiltered.
Yeah. And you're one of the very few people who actually delivers on that on stage. Where you're probably swear more on stage than you do off it. That's usually the way around.
And Vincent, I will debate any point that I've raised in this podcast. If any individual wants to present themselves, either to share the stage with me or to bring some provocations from the audience, I'm open to having the debate that we discussed right at the beginning of the podcast. I think it's really important that we have robust debates and that we have them publicly. I think it's really important that we are all able to stand behind the positions that we support, and that we're able to assert those positions with confidence publicly and in the face of scrutiny. And I'm certainly open to that. And I would hope that your listeners, if they disagree with anything that I've said, that they're welcome to bring that public. Look, hit me up in the DMs as well, of course, as the kids say, hit me in the DMs. Or argue with me in the comments section of Mutual Strangers.
You can be found in both places. Reese, that was an absolute joy. And yeah, as always, but thanks for taking the time. And I'll see you soon.
Cheers, Vincent. Goodbye now.